And in one shot, after the events at Al-Aqsa Mosque, they all combined. So in terms of future militaristic adventures for Israel, I think they will be very hesitant. So I think in that sense, there has been a new deterrence mark set, not militarily yet, but certainly in terms of breaking all of the taboos Israel had helped work to establish very hard about Palestinians uniting on one front.
Well, the next surprise was presented by the large and synchronous missile salvos that were able to bypass Israel's Iron Dome, showcasing the technological advancement that the resistance has developed. And Israel has shown that its top-notch anti-missile system, its defense system, has failed. So if that is the case, how about if they go on in a ground invasion towards Gaza? What will happen then?
Well, firstly, like I said earlier, I do not think Palestinians have established military deterrence yet. Mm-hmm. And it's because, so the Israelis claimed yesterday, I think by yesterday, in a UN report, that there were 2,900 missiles fired from Gaza into Israel. According to the United Nations, 450 bypassed the Iron Dome. And some of those fell in Gaza. But a lot of them reached commercial targets, residential targets, and very essentially, as the Israelis believe, that Palestinians in Gaza are now trying to target Israel's energy sector. They closed the Tamar gas field. Mm-hmm. Because there were drones, Palestinian drones and rockets fired towards it, and Palestinians also fired rockets towards a crude oil pipeline in Israel. So the essential thing here is for us to, don't forget, Palestinians have promised more surprises, much like Hezbollah did in 2006. So we haven't quite seen those yet. We have seen some targeted missiles, but they need to have very accurate, pinpointed, targeted missiles for this to become a major deterrence to the state of Israel. Well, and anti-aircraft missiles, for that matters. I mean, if we see one of those, it's game over for the Israeli Air Force to a certain extent. As for your question about will we see a land attack by Israel, I do not think that makes any sense for the Israelis. They will clock a lot more soldier deaths and possibly kidnappings, which is a worst-case scenario for Israel. They don't go into Gaza, as we've seen in the past, in a light way. They go in heavy with these soldiers burdened down with equipment. They go with armored vehicles and aircraft above. So it will be a very, very hard play for Israel. I don't see them doing a land invasion anytime soon.
Well, the tactics adopted by the resistance showed a serious Israeli intelligence failure, as the intel usually constitutes the basis of any recommendation for a military maneuver or a military operational option. How on earth did Israel fail to the extent that in assessing the anti-Israeli capabilities in its southern front alone, which I'm not saying that it's not enough, but compared to other fronts, it should have assessed it in a better way?
We've seen that Israel isn't very good at this, you know. Contrary to sort of popular impressions, we saw this in 2006, and the Israelis had the Winograd Commission, which they saw very clearly outlined that the state had failed miserably in its intelligence activities leading up to this confrontation. And so why would this be any different? I think the Israelis are very soft in some ways now. They've sort of cruised in cruise control for years, banking on endless American billions and state-of-the-art American military equipment, believing in some way that a qualitative military edge had ensured that Arab states around it would not attack Israel. But this is different. This is from within. So I don't see, you know, Israel continues to have blind spots. Mm-hmm. And if I were Israel, I would be looking at what the Houthis, Ansar Allah, were able to do with pinpoint targeting of missiles at Aramco to understand what Gaza potentially has up its sleeve.
Mm-hmm. Well, apartheid, Israel already knows that this confrontation will have its toll on its regional image in particular, especially with those that they have openly became friends with, especially when their limited capabilities against Gaza were exposed, as you mentioned earlier. Massive questions now are being raised concerning the possible encounter against Hezbollah on the northern front, which enjoys vastly different weaponry and objective advantages. We have seen that in Syria over the past 11 years. After what we have seen in Gaza and the occupied Palestinian territories as well, how do you assess the Israeli position in the event of a confrontation, at least, not to say a war, with Hezbollah on the northern front?
I don't think Israel will be picking bones with Hezbollah right now. It's barely managing to stay on control of the situation in Gaza and the other occupied territories and inside Israel. We have to look at this. Like, Israel canceled its largest ever military exercise just because of some skirmishes in Jerusalem. You know, Hezbollah manages Lebanon's borders, keeping them secure. It fights in Syria. It fights in Iraq. It doesn't cancel a major military exercise because of something that happens in one city. Mm-hmm. So is Israel prepared? No, they're not. They have zero strategic depth, and they have foes on at least three borders that are willing and able to lob missiles at them. From Syria, from Lebanon, and from Gaza. So, as Israel becomes more desperate, one doesn't know what they're going to do, but whether it's a land war or attacking another country in the region, it would be absolutely suicide for Israel.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Hameen Irwani, independent journalist and political commentator, for joining us on this program. Thank you for being here. Please stay tuned next week for more from the Middle East Stream.
First methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is the way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, now we invite you to listen to a speech by Sheikh Hamza Sodagian.
Some of the leaders of the Fiqhi schools of thought were students of Imam al-Sadiq. People hear that. We all hear that. And the common understanding is that, well, Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi, was in a condition that he was more able to spend that time and do that and teach and have classes and so on and so forth. The ones who tried to word it better and to make the imam seem a little more aware of the conditions that he was in and engaging in it, they worded in this way, that the imam saw an opportunity in that there wasn't a strong establishment in terms of government. The Umayyads were going down, they were in the process of being eradicated, and after they were, eventually they got rid of them, people's uprising got rid of the Umayyad dynasty. Then when the Abbasid was establishing itself, it took a number of years, and that gap that didn't allow for there to be a strong establishment that would want to control and to limit the imams, as the imams prior to Imam al-Sadiq and the imams after Imam al-Sadiq experience, the imam took advantage of that. So this is being aware of the conditions of the time. This is, although it might sound like it's doing some justice to Imam al-Sadiq, this is great injustice to Imam al-Sadiq, to Imam al-Baqir, and to Imam Zain al-Abidin, salamullah alayhim ajma'in. And the way it's injustice to them, to all of them, I will briefly put out, but specifically with Imam al-Sadiq, I want to spend a little bit of time talking about what he did and the period that he was in and what all he did. The reason why it's injustice to all those imams is that the conditions that existed at the time, the revolts, the rebellions, the uprisings against the Umayyads, the call for the government of the Ahlul Bayt was the result of the work of Imam Zainul Abidin and Imam Al-Baqir and Imam Al-Sadiq, not something that they just witnessed and they took advantage of that. Some even use the word of they rode those waves, they saw the waves coming and they basically got onto those waves. No, they created those waves. The ones who created the massive waves that overthrew a dynasty that was very strong, in fact, was the Ahlul Bayt, was Imam Zain al-Abidin, was Imam al-Baqir. To not see that is injustice to the imams. That is inaccurate, very inaccurate. But limiting what Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi did to simply having classes and teaching classes and at best perhaps correcting some notions that were inaccurate regarding what the Quran says, what the Prophet said, what the Sunnah of the Prophet is in various areas, which he did all of that. But to think that that is what Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi did is very inaccurate, and it causes us to take an approach which is incorrect. It causes us to move in a direction that is not the direction of the Ahlul Bayt. It causes us to think of Imam al-Sadiq simply as a teacher that was engaged in teaching people regardless of what was happening. This is an approach that many preachers, speakers, even ulama, mujtahideen have unfortunately taken with the justification that this is what the Ahlul Bayt did. Saddam comes, Saddam falls, it doesn't matter. We're going to continue with fiqh. We're going to continue with usul. We're going to spend a little bit of time with ulum al-Quran. We'll spend a little more time with tafsir al-Quran. We'll spend a little bit of time with history. We'll write this book about it. What's going on? People getting slaughtered here, people getting slaughtered there. The kuffar coming in power and controlling the affairs of the believers. Let's just, Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi taught us, just continue with your fiqh, with your usul. If there's ideological questions, ideological problems, okay, we'll address them. All right, these are some great ulama. You have various books written, volumes of works written in the dialogue, as it's called, between Shia and Sunni. While the kuffar are coming and controlling the affairs of the Muslimin, they are using the differences between Shia and Sunni to rule over both of them, to get them to do the killing of each other for the kuffar. Some of these ulama, may Allah bless their souls, they spent that time writing books about the dispute between Shia and Sunni and how we are correct and they are wrong. And we're sitting down and praising the great work that has been written, 8 volumes, 9 volumes. Well, those ahadith were always there. You didn't add anything. The arguments were always there. It's not a new debate. What is alim bi zamanihi mean? Well, this description, this understanding, this approach, this view of Imam al-Sadiq obviously will be leading to this type of approach. When I think my imam, my sixth imam, that I follow his madhab, is someone who cared less about whether it's the Umayyads or the Abbasids or what's going on in Medina, what's going on in Sham, what's going on in Iraq, what's going on in Khorasan, what's going on in Azerbaijan, none of that matters. Let's stick to our class in Medina. We want to teach fiqh to people. If that's my understanding of Imam al-Sadiq, obviously that's how I'm going to respond, that's how I'm going to act today. That's my understanding of Imam al-Sadiq. What do we expect? But is that Imam al-Sadiq? If that's Imam al-Sadiq, then why is Imam al-Sadiq sent to exile for 2 years in Kufa? Why? What's the issue? What problem do they have with Imam al-Sadiq, salamullah alayhi? If this is what Imam al-Sadiq salamullah alayhi did? Why was he summoned time after time after time in various sessions to get the Imam to state that he does not believe in the Imam? There's so many ahadith, so many examples for me to give. There's a time that Abu Mansur, Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, la'natullah alayhi, the first serious ruler of the Abbasids, came to power. He summons the Imam. It's the month of Ramadan. He brings the Imam to his presence. He tells him, is today the month of Ramadan or is it Eid al-Fitr? Obviously, we know that Eid al-Fitr is haram to fast. You've got to break your fast. And during the month of Ramadan, it's haram to break your fast. It's wajib to fast. The Imam is brought there. The question is this. Is today the beginning of the month of Shawwal? Is today Eid al-Fitr? Or is it the month of Ramadan? What type of stupid question is that? Do we approach that question in this very simple ways of some idiot asking the Imam to come? That's a stupid way of looking at that situation. You think this ruler that was able to destroy all competition in the Abbasid family and establish his rule for those many years was stupid enough to just bring the Imam, ask him a ridiculous question like that? The question that he's posing to the Imam is trying to get him to reveal what his views are, to say something. He knows what his views are, to say something about leadership. One of the rules in Islam is that if the Islamic ruler identifies a day to be the day of Eid, it's the day of Eid. And if he identifies that day to be the month of Ramadan, it's the month of Ramadan. He wants the Imam to say that today is Eid or the month of Ramadan, to consider that a claim of imamah, of governance, to say that in his presence, to give him an excuse to reveal what his beliefs regarding himself, Abu Ja'far al-Mansur, as he called himself. That's what he's trying to do. And the Imam, in his clever ways, he said, today is whatever the Hakim says. And that fool thinks that the Imam means him. The Imam is saying, yes, whatever the Hakim says. He doesn't say who the Hakim is. Whatever you say, he said, it's Eid. Again, he's putting that to test. He knows it's the month of Ramadan, but since he considers himself the ruler, he wants the Imam to follow that. He says, it's Eid, break your fast. The Imam breaks his fast. This is taqiyya. What is this? What's this set up for? If the Imam is simply teaching fiqh, he doesn't care. Umayyads are there, Abbasids are there. Who cares? We're just going to teach our fiqh class. Why does Abu Ja'far al-Mansur have such an issue with the Imam? Not once. This is one of the instances. Why is he sent to exile? Exile, 2 years.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Rahi Karim Adi Ali.
Ya If you are interested to know about history, culture, family, religion, sports, politics, art, and etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune in to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Our website is english.irib.ir.
انسان را مطمئن می کند ذکر خداست، ذکر الله تطمئن القلوب.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
الله يا الله سبحان الله، الله يا الله والحمد لله، الله ولا إله
Imam Khomeini's viewpoints on the issue of Palestine. The Zionists are not people of religion. Perhaps those few misled Jews who have come together there from different parts of the world now regret what they have done. Perhaps those Jews who do not want anything other than the lofty teachings of Moses now regret going there. For once they see at first hand what the plan is of this group who call themselves Jews, yet who act against the teachings of Hazrat Moses, who kill people for no reason and align themselves with America and others. They will not be able to put up with this. We know that the Jewish community is quite different from the Zionist community. We oppose the latter. Our opposition arising from the fact that they oppose all the religions. They are not Jews. They are political people who, calling themselves Jews, perpetrate certain acts. The Jews despise them, as all people should. That was the short part of Imam Khomeini's speech at the gathering of Jewish Society of Iran, May 14, 1979.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another episode of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi. We were talking about the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islam. Imam Khomeini has said that the Islam has elucidated on everything, but the problems are on the Muslims. In another saying, he refers to the Muslims and he says that the main problem of the Muslims is their drifting away from Islam and the Quran. This is a big matter which Imam Khomeini is talking about. It's because of us Muslims drifting away from Islam and Quran that the enemies are obviously handling us. It is because of us being drifting away from the Islam and Quran that today we have all these issues in the world. The Muslims are oppressed because of this issue, because they're away from the Quran. Now, look at the Muslim population. And if you want to do a survey, you can ask and do a survey from Muslims next to you that how many of them have once finished the Quran with the translation? Or maybe like how many of them has just read the translation of the second chapter of the Quran? You won't find anyone. You will find just a few people. Now look at the population of the Muslims. And on top of that, Quran is the book which is the book of guidance, because Allah says that this Quran is hudan lil muttaqin. This Quran is a guidance for the muttaqin, for the people. Hada bayanun lin nas. This is a clear statement for the mankind. Now, when it is a clear statement for mankind, when it is the means of guidance which is sent from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, if those who are supposed to get guidance from it, if they leave it, if they do not pay attention towards it, what's going to happen? Obviously, they will not going to go towards perfection. They will not going to get the perfection. They will not going to be succeeded in this world.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
In the modern era, man has reached ever new technological heights unprecedented in history. We can now communicate and interact with those halfway around the world with ease, manage workloads with a click of a finger, or access information and news in a matter of seconds. Perhaps a world without electronic technology would be unimaginable. But this miraculous blessing has a very, very dark and toxic underbelly. I'm Zari Shajeri, and this is Aperture. The electronic technology we are so dependent on creates waste unseen in the Earth's history. Every year, up to 50 million tons of electronic waste, computers, television sets, mobile phones, and household appliances are thrown away by consumers in the developed countries. 75% of this waste disappears from the legal recycling circuit, much of it dumped illegally in the third world. Stay with us as this week's documentary spans the world to reveal how greed and corruption are ruining the globe's legal recycling systems, damaging the environment, creating security risks, and endangering human health.
We produce up to 50 million tons of e-waste every single year, and our discarded appliances increasingly end up in places like in Africa. We first came here 3 years ago while risking serious health problems such as cancer and brain damage. Since then, the situation has worsened dramatically. The amount of e-waste coming into Africa has almost doubled. And also in Europe, South America, and Asia, the discarded symbols of our modern lifestyle are corroding landscapes and poisoning the soil, water, and air.
It's a crime. I mean, this is a crime of mammoth proportions.
E-waste trafficking is huge and said to be bigger than the drugs trade. Even though the export of e-waste has been banned for more than 30 years, thousands of e-waste containers cross the oceans every year. And the toxic tide is set to rise even further because, in spite of the crisis, the sale of electronics is booming and emerging markets are coming on board. All contribute to a growing mountain of e-waste to which we can no longer turn a blind eye.
It's like a doctor looking at a patient bleeding profusely and saying, oh, it's not so bad. When I hear people like that, I say, just go. Just take a plane and go look for yourself and tell me that's not a problem.
All over the world, law enforcement, environmental activists, customs officials, and undercover investigators are fighting to stop the traffickers.
Para ese tipo de personas, el futuro no cuenta. Lo que cuenta es el beneficio inmediato.
The battle is difficult to win because of the huge profits to be made and the corruption involved.
C'est tout un système de montage avec des sociétés écrans. Là, on peut parler de système mafieux.
Can we stop the toxic tide before it is too late? Mike Anane is a Ghanaian environmental journalist and activist. He has made it his personal mission to stop the influx of e-waste to his country. He has discovered that many of the computers dumped here still bear the names of their original owners in Europe and the US.
I'm looking for the asset tags or the property tags. Yes, it gives a lot of indication and provide a clue as to who owned it, who used it.
Mike told me that he had a plan. He wanted to take his collection of tags on a journey of investigation.
The idea is to take these things back to the previous owners, the original owners. And these are e-waste that belong to people in the UK. I'll ask them questions as to how these things got to Ghana, if they have any idea. Somebody has to pay for these things because the environmental and health consequences are enormous. They are killing people here. They should be responsible.
Mike is taking several pieces of e-waste to the UK. The first one originally belonged to Leeds City Council.
Dear Mr. Councillor, my name is Mike Anan. I would like to come and see you to show you what I found and to investigate how your discarded computer equipment found its way to Ghana. This is the moment that I have been waiting for, to listen to their side of the story.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Pleased to meet you. Councillor David Blackburn, if you want to come this way with me.
Okay. I collect the asset tax of some of the e-waste that gets dumped in Ghana.
Royal College of Nursing, yes. HMS Customs at Thames Valley.
South Bank University.
South Bank University, that's in London. So you've got a fair spread of England, you know.
Let me show you the place where I found this equipment.
This is where I keep the e-waste that have asset tags or property tags. You know, when you look at this, for instance, it says Leeds City Council. It should have been disposed of in that city of Leeds.
Terrible, huh? Terrible. Yeah, not acceptable at all. Is this the same all over Africa, or is there specific parts of Africa where we're having problems with it?
We have Nigeria and, of course, Ghana.
Mm.
Yeah, these two countries are the major countries that receive electronic waste.
We've researched, as far as we can, that particular piece of waste from the serial number they can date it. But, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago, and as I said, at that time, I mean, the ethical, what was thought to be ethical was, we'll recondition them and give them to charities that can't afford their own computers. But I don't think anybody actually thought the thing through, that what happens when it is no longer in use.
The records of the donations no longer exist, so Councillor Blackburn can't tell Mike which computer went to which charity. The trail has gone cold. Mike tries to trace back more of the tags he has found in Ghana.
Good afternoon. My name is Mike Anani. I'm trying to reach 212 regarding some recycling issues. Do you have anybody around?
Yeah, at the moment, it's in place security issues. We've gone into administration. We've been taken over by Daisy.
Mm-hmm.
All recyclers involved were closed down or sold on years ago.
This number is for sale. For information, call Odin.
After a whole week in the UK trying to trace back the tags, Mike still doesn't know who sent the e-waste to Ghana.
I'm very much disappointed. I have been to several places and the usual excuses has been 20 years or we give them to charity. And I find these excuses rather funny. Yeah, because it doesn't take away the problems, it doesn't take away their complicity, and it doesn't take away the fact that they are to be blamed.
Uncovering the e-waste traffic is not as simple as Mike had expected, but he is determined to continue his investigation. E-waste trafficking has been illegal since 1989, when the Basel Convention was signed, the first international treaty banning the trafficking of any kind of toxic waste. To date, 190 countries have signed it, amongst them China and Ghana. The European Union, too, has written the Basel Convention into its laws, prohibiting the export of e-waste. In other words, all EU waste should be recycled in Europe. A system has been designed. In Europe, when a consumer buys a new appliance, the purchase price includes a recycling levy. For instance, the price of a fridge includes a levy of up to 20 euros. Around 4 billion euros are collected this way in Europe every year. This money is used by the industry to run a system which collects, sorts, transports, and recycles our appliances. That's why we can hand them back for recycling for free when we discard them. Thousands of highly specialized recycling plants have been set up all over Europe. Here, the e-waste is treated without harming the workers or the environment. Professional recyclers can get a whole range of valuable materials out of our discarded appliances. But recyclers all over Europe are complaining that their plants are not running to full capacity. And the European Union estimates that at least two-thirds of European e-waste never make it to an official recycling plant. Spain is one of the worst affected countries. So what's going wrong? Belén Ramos works for OQ, Spain's biggest consumer association. She wants to find out why Spanish e-waste is not getting to the recycling plants through an experiment. Belén and her team are installing satellite trackers inside discarded appliances that could have come from any of our homes. In total, 16 pieces have been fitted with trackers. The plan is to hand them in for recycling all over the country and see if they find their way to a recycling plant or not. Soon, all the pieces of e-waste with the hidden trackers inside are distributed all over the country. All of them are sending regular satellite signals. This morning, there is news from the city of Granada, where a computer with a tracker was handed in for recycling. The satellite picture shows clearly that the new location of the computer is an abandoned lot and not a recycling plant. In a country with 26% unemployment and paltry benefits, some have turned to e-waste theft to survive. Security cameras and metal gates failed to deter the thieves. Fences are simply cut to provide access 24 hours. The copper cone inside a TV set can be sold to a scrap dealer for 2 euros. A fridge will yield up to 10 euros, and a system unit 4 euros. But theft from collection points is not the only way e-waste is disappearing. In 2011, the Spanish Environmental Police discovered that 500,000 fridges had been siphoned off the official system and dumped. The case became known as Operation Fragmento, Spain's first high-profile e-waste case. A large criminal network, which included staff at collection points, recycling plants, and transport firms, had taken the recycling levy and then illegally scrapped the fridges. Their profit, 10 million euros. The case is currently pending trial. The final balance of Belén's tracker experiment, only 4 of the 16 pieces made it to authorized recycling plants. All others were scrapped illegally. That's 75%. But none of Belen's trackers have appeared outside of Spain. So how does European e-waste end up in the Third World? An answer can be found in France. Here, in March 2010, the Gendarmerie discovered a huge warehouse full of e-waste, tucked away in a small town. Captain Doblemont was in charge of the investigation. So where did all this e-waste come from, and where was it going? D3E Recyclage had collected electronics for recycling from all over the region. Clients included public institutions, hospitals, and prisons, and even the Gendarmerie itself. The e-waste came flooding in for one reason. Under French law, companies have to pay for their old equipment to be recycled, but D3E offered an irresistible deal. Free recycling of monitors, which would normally have cost around €5 each to recycle. Nobody thought this was a deal too good to be true, because the paperwork provided by D3E Recyclage looked totally convincing. They even listed individual serial numbers, claiming that everything had been recycled according to the law. For several years, D3E operated calmly under the radar. Not a single inspection took place, which would have revealed that they didn't have any recycling equipment whatsoever. D3E may have only been a small company, but they were part of an international e-waste trafficking ring covering three continents. When Captain Doblemont discovered that the waste had left France for Belgium, he contacted Interpol for help. A huge international network began to reveal itself. The French monitors had been sold for between 50 cents and €2 a piece to a company in Belgium called Mobo. The investigators traced the head office of Mobo to Luxembourg. A truly international network was uncovered. Mobo in Luxembourg bought e-waste not only from France, but also from Croatia and the UK. They used a Romanian company for packing and logistics. The e-waste was exported from Holland to Hong Kong, Vietnam, and the Arab Emirates. The shareholders are based in the US, in Delaware, a notorious fiscal paradise. The French e-waste suppliers have been sentenced, and their fake recycling company shut down. But Mobo continued to trade, advertising their services on sites such as Alibaba.com, where e-waste from all around the world is traded freely and without borders. Thousands of e-waste containers leave Europe every year. This not only causes environmental damage, it also affects the economy. This was a major reason why, in 2008, the European institutions in Brussels started work on a new, more stringent version of the EU e-waste directive.
10% of all the gold in the world goes to electronics, and most of it then disappears. And the same with silver, with copper.
Every year, Europe dumps millions of tons of e-waste, including the valuable resources inside.
I think everybody needs to wake up to the fact that in 20 or 30 years, the world is going to have a huge resource crisis. And Europe in particular is very vulnerable. We import 6 times more than we export.
Europe currently spends €130 billion a year on importing strategic metals, even though some of this demand could be covered with recycled e-waste instead. This refinery in Belgium extracts copper, tin, silver, and gold from old electronics and processes them for resale. 50,000 mobile phones yield 1 kilogram of gold and 10 kilograms of silver, worth about €40,000. Currently, only 1% of mobile phones are recycled in Europe. This means that we're actually sitting on a veritable mine of precious metals and valuable rare earths. January 2012, the European Parliament passed the new e-waste directive. The new goal is to increase e-waste recycling in Europe by making it easier for consumers to hand back their waste and by keeping the waste in Europe through stricter export controls at the harbors. But how easy is it to stop an e-waste container from leaving? Mike Anane has travelled to Scotland to meet the Environmental Protection Agency.
Historically, it's been West Africa, primarily Nigeria, but over the last few years we have noticed an increase to Ghana.
What are the usual tricks that these illegal exporters use?
For example, changing the container drop-off point to the last minute so as we can't be there to check, or potentially having material on the first few rows of the container that are working order, but sort of material sitting behind that that's not working order.
Only functional second-hand equipment can legally be exported from Europe. Everything else is seized.
So do you test every single equipment for functionality?
Not every single equipment. The amount of exports that takes place and the resource, it wouldn't be cost-effective. We have to use the resources effectively.
The team use a video camera to look inside the container and to see if any of the contents look like e-waste.
You were checking a 40-footer container, but the camera was not long enough to the end of the container.
It's another indication. That's why the majority of our effort goes into the use of intelligence and the use of inspections at an earlier stage. But we've already had information from that exporter to show that each of the fridges had been tested, but that was a spot check to ensure that the paperwork they'd given us matched up.
Mike is not impressed. The Scottish authorities, making the best of their resources, rely on information from the exporters themselves to stop any illegal shipments. The container was released for export soon after.
For me, I would say that the control that I saw at the port in Scotland was not good enough. Every single item would have to be checked for functionality, particularly of the contents. If it's refrigerators, if it's television sets or computers, they would have to find out whether they are working in good working order before they're shipped or whether they're just junk.
In spite of all European laws, Europe's harbours are clearly overwhelmed by the sheer number of e-waste containers being exported. What about a country that produces more e-waste than anyone else on the planet and hasn't banned its export? The US produces a staggering 9.5 million tons of e-waste a year. A lot of this is collected by recyclers, for instance, at so-called recycling rallies, where people are invited to donate their discarded electronics to charity. What most people don't know is that a lot of U.S. e-waste is headed straight for the third world.
If you were to go out on the street and ask people, what do you think happens when you take your old computer to a recycler, they'll just say it gets recycled. Very few know that most of these so-called recyclers in the United States don't recycle, they just export.
This is Foresight. A program on how to worship Allah. Today's great tip, what are the specific secrets and some of the outcomes of the Friday congregational prayers which can enhance and strengthen our ubudiyah, our servitude of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So, dear listeners, we've been talking in a few of our programs about the spiritual and even material blessings that come with the Friday congregational prayers and how these Friday congregational prayers have specific instances, and they have outcomes which can enhance our ubudiyya, they can enhance our servitude and our obedience to Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted. So, getting right to the subject, one of the things which the Friday congregational prayers, the Salatul Jum'ah, does is that it enhances the spirit of collectivity of this collection, of this group of people that have gathered together in these Friday congregational prayers. Of course, one of the things which Allah, the Mighty, the Exalted, has requested humanity to do as an individual is to take care of each other, to be concerned about each other, to help one another, to support one another. And so this support, this help, this being a part of a group, a part of humanity, concerned about humanity, is of course in itself a form of servitude of Allah. And so, dear friends, in these Friday congregational prayers, we find that human beings are like scattered drops which come together into a single ocean. And through mutual communication and acquaintances, all of these scattered drops acquire the spirit of collectivity, the spirit of unity, and thus dissension, discord, selfishness, greed, individualism gradually start to vanish. These are beautiful statements, these are beautiful outcomes, which are directly linked to our servitude of Allah. We should always try to delve a little deeper, think a little bit more profoundly, and don't look at the superficial level of things. Here, would have we ever thought that this spirit of collectivity, this communication, this friendship, this brotherhood, and this removal of individualism and selfishness and dissension and discord which comes due to the Friday congregational prayers, did we think that all of these spiritual blessings can come from something such as Friday congregational prayers? Perhaps we didn't, but now we know that even something as simple or something as average and normal as Friday congregational prayers can have great impacts upon our servitude to Allah, the Great, the Almighty.
Assalamu alaikum, dear brothers and sisters. Welcome to this segment of Foresight coming to you from IRIB English Radio. My name is Muhammad, and today I would like to read to you the English translation of an excerpt from Munajatu Shakirin, the Whispered Prayer of the Thankful. Please stay with me. My God, my thanksgiving is small before your great boons, and my praise and new spreading shrink beside your generosity toward me. Your favors have wrapped me in the robes of the lights of faith, and the gentlenesses of your goodness have let down over me delicate curtains of might. Your kindnesses have colored me with colors not to be moved, and adorned me with neck rings not to be broken. Your boons are abundant. My tongue is too weak to count them. Your favors are many. My understanding falls short of grasping them, not to speak of exhausting them. So how can I achieve thanksgiving? For my thanking you requires thanksgiving. Whenever I say, to you belongs praise, it becomes thereby incumbent upon me to say, to you belongs praise.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying regarding the specific secrets of the Friday congregational prayers and the very special outcomes and manifestations of the Friday congregational prayers as regards to our ubudiyya, our servitude of Allah, our obedience of Allah, the Mighty, the Great. So we had just talked about in the last segment how these Friday congregational prayers bring unity to the Muslims. It is like these scattered drops come together and turn into a single ocean, an ocean which is worshipping Allah, an ocean which is in the servitude of Allah, an ocean which is collectively, while made up of separate individuals, is in the ubudiyya, in the obedience, in the servitude, in the worship of Allah, the Mighty and the Great. We also talked about how things are also removed, purified from these individuals when a person sees this single ocean made up of individuals. It takes away the selfishness, it takes away greed, it takes away jealousy, it takes away discord, it takes away this concept of everything is me, 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 I am the center of the world. These things gradually start to vanish if we bother to think a little deeper. Another one of the specific secrets of the Friday congregational prayers is that the Friday congregational prayers are the center for the mobilization of the ubudiyya of Allah. It is a stronghold and it is the best place to invite people and mobilize them towards action, towards defense, towards solving social and economic problems, from rendering assistance to others. So this becomes a center for mobilization, it becomes a center for action, and this again is a form of ubudiyya, it is a form of servitude to Allah, because Allah, the Almighty, the Great, the Beneficent, the Merciful, has requested all of us to take action. Do not be passive, do not be lazy, do not be hopeless, do not be useless. Take action. Be active in your life, be active in the life of your family, be active in the life of your friends. Yes, respectfully, of course, but be active, care for others, help others. And so the Friday congregational prayers, one of its outcomes, one of its manifestations, one of its secrets, which is directly linked to the servitude of Allah and the servitude and obedience of Allah and His ubudiyya, is the fact that it calls us to action, to help, to improve, to reform, to transform, and to progress in our lives and the lives of those around us. And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Imam Jafar al-Sadiq alayhi salatu wasalam, he actually narrates his tradition in Kafi, Usul al-Kafi. He talks about the fact that in my youth, when I was younger, I did a lot of worship for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It's one of my favorite traditions. I wish that we could really truly understand this tradition. a lot of worship in my youth, to the point where my father, Imam Muhammad Baqir alayhi salam, would tell me that you don't need to push yourself, or you don't need to do that much worship, because when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala loves somebody, He accepts very little from them. He expects very little, and He accepts very little from them. It's just a matter of us convincing myself that God loves me. And if God was to ask you, where have I ever told you? When have I ever told you?